yourself someday.
Hello, world. Welcome to Living to Write, where we talk with notable writers about their methods, careers, and advice for other writers. I'm Brian Landwehr, and I am a writer. If you are too, or you'd like to be, you are in the right place. With me each episode is my buddy, Bailey Patterson, who is also a writer when he isn't busy producing this fine podcast. Hello there, Bailey.
Hello, mate. Hello, world.
Mate. That's new. I like that. Is that a Canadianism, or is that just you being you today?
That's just me being me. Yeah, yeah. No Canadianisms.
Okay, that's fine. I approve. I have a lot of respect for the animated show King of the Hill.
Yeah.
It was very funny, and the writing was always sharp, but the show never seemed overly proud of itself, if that makes sense. It just worked. Were you a fan of the show back in the day? Have you seen a lot of it, Bailey?
I haven't seen a lot of King of the Hill, but I'm very familiar with the show and the tone of it. You know, I know they stand by the fence and all drink beer. I know. Yeah, that's a big part of it.
You're thinking of the correct show. Yeah, it was a great show. And Mike Judge, Beavis and Butthead guy, he created an absolutely fantastic show. And after as bizarre and subversive as Beavis and Butthead was, this show was initially a really big surprise, because this is just a good sitcom. Whatever you came in expecting, if you like a good sitcom, this is a good sitcom.
Interesting.
And so our audience will be unsurprised that the reason I'm bringing up King of the Hill is that Bailey has gotten us a fantastic guest who is King of the Hill adjacent.
Our guest today is Michael Jamin. He's a TV writer and showrunner, but most recently he is a novelist, the right term? Maybe memoirist? I don't... Essayist? You know, I don't really know how
I'm not sure of the best way to categorize his new book either. And his new book is entitled...
A Paper Orchestra.
A Paper Orchestra. Yes, yes. A Paper Orchestra. Thank you.
And an interesting thing about Michael is when COVID happened, everybody downloaded TikTok, except you, Brian.
Well,
I got sucked into it.
Yeah, it's fair.
Michael's page came up and he would do these lives and he would talk about writing on King of the Hill, and he would just sort of talk about his career. And I think it was a way of him to sort of get back to the community and something to do during COVID. And now, you know, 3 years later, he's built up his following to, I think, over 600,000 on TikTok. He's got 200,000, I believe, on Instagram. So he's been a really big presence in the writing community. And I wanted to get him on the show today. I'm really excited to sort of see his perspective. I think he can give us a different insight on the industry than maybe some others have.
He has a lot of content out there. He shows up regularly and shares interesting stories, interesting insights, and he seems to have mastered it very quickly. Mm-hmm. He feels like he belongs there. I think that's fair to say.
I totally agree.
Are you ready? Shall we get him in here?
Let's do it, Brian.
Perfect.
Let's do it, mate.
Mate. Yes. Mate. Yes. Mate. Today I'm mate.
You're mate today.
Perfect. Dear listeners, I now give you Michael Jamin.
Lights, camera, action.
Hello.
Hey, hello, Michael. Thank you so much for joining us.
For having me.
I have learned a lot about you in the last couple of days looking at your site and reading about some of the projects you've been involved with. Bailey was telling me that he has followed you since, what, early COVID times on TikTok? Is that what you were saying, Bailey?
Yeah, I think I've been an early follower, definitely, for sure, like 10,000 or something.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're an OG.
An OG.
Yeah.
Your social media presence is incredibly impressive, as are the variety of projects that you've been involved in and continue to be involved with. Since we're really here to emphasize the writing side of things, even though I have so many questions about shows you've been involved in as kind of a fanboy, why are you a writer? Why not something else? Why is it writing for you?
Well, that's something I wanted to do ever since I was a kid. Ever since I was watching TV, I was like, hey, I want to be the person who makes up those, who writes for those characters. That's what I thought, especially when I was watching Cheers. Cheers was the first show. I was like, ah, wouldn't it be great if I could be a writer on Cheers?
Did you do much writing when you were a kid for whatever audience, for whatever reason?
Yeah, I mean, I remember writing when I was just writing stories when I was in first grade, and then shooting little films when I was like, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old. And then in high school, I started writing satire. And then in college, took creative writing courses and stuff like that.
Do you feel like the creative writing courses that you took in college really upped your game? Or was it a bit of a, do you feel like your skills were pretty well developed at that point?
No, it was a disaster. So I,
oh.
No, that didn't help at all. I had some great professors. Russell Banks and was one of them. But I didn't feel like I was being taught creative. I really wanted to become I wanted to learn. And as great of a writer he was, I didn't feel like the classes were, I wasn't a good writer in college, and no one could figure out how to help me. And then I tried to become a major. I tried to major in creative writing, and I was rejected twice. I write about this actually in one of the stories in my book. I was rejected twice. And I felt like I was, that was it. You know, I'm 19, 20 years old, and college is telling me it's not going to, I don't get to be a writer. It wasn't until I moved to California and I studied screenwriting where I really learned how to become a writer.
At that point in college, did you think you were a good writer, or did you agree that your writing was a mess?
No, I didn't think I was a good writer. I thought there were some moments like, oh, this is funny, this could be funny, but I knew I didn't know how to write. And not many people do know how to write, especially when you're young. And so when I was rejected, I knew I wasn't a good writer. That's why I wanted to take creative writing, someone could teach me how to become a writer.
And how did you end up making it from being at university to actually being a gainfully employed writer? How did you get your start in the industry? What was your big break, with air quotes?
There's a bunch of little breaks. It really was no big break. But so I moved to California right after college, moved to LA. I studied screenwriting under a guy. I wanted to be a sitcom writer. So I didn't want to learn from a professional teacher. I wanted to learn from someone who had the job that I wanted. And so I found this guy who was retired, and he wrote on a bunch of like Andy Griffith Show and Twilight Zone and all the old shows, Get Smart. And I studied under him for a little bit. And then I wound up, I met a writing partner, and we started writing together. And then from there, my first paying gig, I was a joke writer on a show called The Mike and Maddie Show. That was about 6 months I lasted. And then together with my writing partner, we sold a freelance episode of Lois and Clark, which was the Superman show. And then a year, maybe a couple of years after that, we wound up getting on staff of a show called Just Shoot Me, where we've been working steadily pretty much ever since.
And you're still writing with your writing partner?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Wow. So how specifically did you end up hired on Just Shoot Me? How did you end up in the room there?
We had an agent, and she got our script into a pile of scripts. And the Steve Levitan was the creator of Just Shoot Me, and his assistant read, you know, the show was just picked up from a pilot, and she read a ton of scripts, and she liked ours, and she passed it along to Steve, and Steve hired us.
Your agent passed that along.
Yeah.
We've got plenty of people in our audience who are early in careers, dreaming of careers. And I do hear a lot of talking about sending off unsolicited material. No to that, right?
Yeah, never, never, ever, ever do that. You expose that person to liability. I won't look at it. I'll get sued. The minute you send me your crappy script about a talking dog, well, I got a crappy script about talking. Now you're going to sue me. Everyone in Hollywood has a script about a talking dog. So you never, ever send, you ask permission. And if the answer is no, you respect that. And if the answer is yes, then you can send them whatever they want to read.
So barring that, if you want to get somebody looking at what you've written, you need an agent.
Yeah. And then how do you get an agent is a bigger question. But I think everyone jumps the gun on this. Everyone thinks they're ready to be read. Everyone thinks whatever the script they're holding in their hand should be shot tomorrow and give me $1 million for it. And I'm telling you, the vast majority of scripts that I read from emerging writers, and I'm talking about 99.5%, are just not good enough. They're just, you're not ready. And but everyone thinks they're ready. Everyone thinks they're in the top 1%.
Is there any way to summarize what tends to be most broken about these screenplays from emerging writers, or is it just everything?
It's everything. Most people don't even understand what a story is. They have no idea what a story is. And so they'll give you a script where shit is happening. Shit happening is not a story. And it took me a long time to learn. Everyone thinks because they hold a pencil, they can write. It's just not the case. Like, writing is like a lifelong pursuit. You don't get good just because you did it once. You got to keep writing and writing, and you get better. I'm embarrassed at the stuff that I wrote years ago. I'm embarrassed at the stuff I wrote last year. Like, you constantly get better, you know?
So what does your process look like? How do you get the work done? How do you get the pages out? Are you a same time every morning type of writer, or are you a when it strikes you sort of thing? How do you do it?
Well, when I'm working on a television show with my writing partner, we do everything together. We sit down together. We literally look at the page at the same time. And so when you have a partner, you keep hours, you know, and so it's very steady. But when I was working on my book, it was a very different process. So, because that's all my, I did that on my own.
Gotcha. And the book was self-published as well, yes?
Yeah. And that was because it's one of those things. I had this burning passion to write. I love David Sedaris. I love the way he writes. He writes personal.
Me too.
So that was what my intention was, to sit down. I wanted to, what would my version of that be? And so I wrote something like that. It took me a couple of years to learn how to write that way. There's literally, you know, I have an agent. We shopped it around. And the note I got back, everyone wanted to change it. Everyone wanted it to be something different. And the thing is, I wanted to write, like, you know, first of all, there's no money in making a book, right? So writing a book. So there's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And so they wanted to change it so that I could sell it for $5,000. And I'm like, I'm not changing it. I'm not doing this for the money. I'm doing it because I want to create something art. I want something closer to art than what I'm used to doing as a sitcom writer. And so at the end, I was like, I was unwilling to compromise even a letter, because that's not why I was doing it. I'm not doing it for the money. I'm doing it to write something really good. And so that's why I did it myself. I published it myself.
Full disclosure, I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I have listened to part of your audiobook. And first of all, nice job with the audiobook.
Thank you.
Production value of it is fantastic. And your presentation of it is fantastic. Also, though, I'm going to sit down and read it off the page. I'm also a big fan of David Sedaris, and I love his voice, and I've been to see him speak a couple of times and absolutely adore him. But also, there's something a little important about his writing in my mind, and for some reason, I like to get it off the page first. And honestly, that's the reaction I've had to what I heard of your book. It seems important, and I kind of want to read it off the page. So I'm very excited about it. It seems fantastically done. So congrats on getting that out.
Yeah, that's another thing. We wanted to produce, as a TV producer, I know how to produce. I knew how I wanted the audiobook to be. And if I went with a publisher, I was going to do it the way they wanted it. I just was not willing to compromise on this, which is okay. You know, you do it yourself then.
Sure. And do I understand correctly, there was a one-man show before there was the essays?
Here it is. So I like David Sedaris, so he tours with his work and he reads it. So I tour with it as well, but I'm more performative. It's more of a performance. And so we've done a number of shows in LA. I have two shows in LA this June. I have two more in August. Then we're doing Brooklyn and then Monterey Bay. And then I think Chicago's in the works. And so the goal is intentionally is to kind of travel the country with my little dog and pony show and to perform my work. My goal is to write another one. That's what I want to do. Keep doing this.
How did you find the experience of being an essayist? How did the writing process, your thought process, compare to the other writing you've done for sitcoms and such?
You know, when I first started, I had this idea in my head. This is 5 years ago. At that point, I'd listened to a bunch of David Sedaris's books on audiobook. I was like, maybe I should do something like that. maybe I should write an audio, you know, write a collection of personal essays. And so then I ordered a bunch of his books in print because I hadn't read them yet. I'd only listened to them for years. And then I, you know, how hard can it be? I'm a TV writer. And I got one of his books and I'm halfway through the first chapter of the first book that I randomly picked up. And I'm like, where is he going with this? What's this about? And then I got to the end of the story and it was so beautiful. I almost threw it across the room. I was like, oh no, this is going to be way harder than I thought. And then, so then I just began, I just started writing what I thought. But because I'm a TV writer, my job is not to have a voice. My job is to have the voice of the show, the voice of the character. So now I'm a really good mimic. You know, I get hired on a show and dive right in. And I started writing these pieces. And then I started realizing, I wrote one or two and I read them back. And I was very happy with it. And then I read it with fresh eyes a couple of months later. And I was like, oh no, this just sounds like I'm doing a pale imitation of David Sedaris. It sounds like I'm trying to be him. And I was so disappointed with what I wrote. I tossed it out. And then I was like, then I spent the next several months figuring out what my voice is and how I wanted my stories to sound. So I had to kind of reinvent myself. Or I had to invent myself, not even reinvent.
Did you end up telling the same set of stories with a different voice? Or did you even reconsider the stories that were to be included?
I don't even remember. It's a great question. I don't even remember. I don't know. I've tossed out, like I write more stories than I publish. So my guess is I'm almost certain those did not wind up in the book. A lot of it was, you know, the first stories were really about, you know, like I said, figuring out who I am and how I want to tell stories. And not everything that I write is worth sharing, you know? So.
Well, congrats on inventing yourself along the way. Did you end up at least finding out that you're a pretty cool guy?
You know, it's a very, I drew from my experience as a sitcom writer. My partner and I were the head writers of a show called Marin on IFC starring Mark Maron.
Love it.
Okay, so you know that. So Mark, I learned a lot about writing this way from being the head writer on Mark's show. Mark was very, very vulnerable, very truthful. Often we'd be in the writer's room and it was based on his life. So he'd say, I want to do a story about this incident in my life. And it was whatever, half a minute long. And I remember saying, like, really? Are you sure? It's kind of personal, don't you think, Mark? He says, no, that's what I want to do. So he was always very brave and just going for it. And so when I was writing this, I was like, well, I want to tell the truth, but I want to figure out what the truth is. And then I want to be brave enough to share it. And I drew a lot of inspiration from Mark's bravery to do that.
And to do that well, you've got to figure it out and be brave enough to share it, but then write it in such a way that it doesn't sound like you're announcing how brave you are.
Yeah. Well, I think the point of good writing is not necessarily, it's not, you know, look how brave I am. Look how great I am. It's not look how interesting I am. It's look how human I am.
Yeah.
And a lot of people get that wrong. Although often they'll write and it's look how cute I am. I don't like that at all.
When you were working on the book, you talked about the moment you stopped and weren't thrilled with what you'd written and started again. After you started again, do you have a specific brainstorming process that you go through when you're writing? Is brainstorming one thing and then writing another? Is it something that happens organically together? And I guess toward that, are you an outliner planner or a seat of your pantser when it's time to write? That's a bunch of questions. I've sort of mashed them into one. I hope you can peel that apart.
I'll probably forget what you asked. But in TV, you write everyone, you work out, you break the story. So you have 8 or 10 writers in a room and you spend a week or so figuring out what the beats of the story are on a whiteboard. It's all outlined. There's no seat of your pants. Everything is agreed upon and understood by the team of writers. And that's how you hopefully get a high quality product week after week. With this book, I didn't want to write that way. I wanted it to be organic. And so I just started writing. It was very inefficient, the way I wrote the book. It was more like, let's just see where this goes. And I'd sit down with a vague idea, a vague memory. And the memory might be almost nothing. Like the memory was one of them was I took a swing dance lessons years ago. I took dance classes. Okay, that's all. That's my notes. I write a story about dance classes. And then I just start writing. And then I maybe 10 drafts into it, I'm hoping to find the story. Sometimes I don't find the story, in which case I give up or look at it later. Or if I am lucky enough to find the story, then I go back and rewrite the hell out of it. So each story is easily 20 to 40 drafts before it's ready to be seen.
You mentioned there that sometimes if the stories weren't working out, if you couldn't find the heart of it, you would give up on it. Yep. When you're in a more structured situation, such as you're in a writer's room for a show, and when it obviously just has to get done, is writer's block a thing that you run into? Do you ever feel stuck, or are you just always rolling forward? Maybe you don't think you found the best version of the idea or the best version of the joke, but do you ever really feel stuck?
We don't have the luxury of saying we're stuck, because we get paid to write. And if we're not, you know, I can't take the day off and go to the beach. The studio will fire me. So, yeah, you got to just muscle through, and you rely on the story structure, and you rely on everything you've learned, and hopefully, and then, you know, there are 8 or 10 writers, and hopefully someone can help move that rock up the hill. Writing is hard. I think for me, if you're having fun doing it, you're doing it wrong.
In the writer's room, well, multiple rooms, have you tended to be more in the joke room, like the guys who put the funny in what's already been structured? Or have you also been on the side where we are breaking story and figuring out what our beats are going to be?
So back in the day, when I was breaking in, the writing rooms were bigger. And often people would say, are you a joke person or a story person? And with my partner and I was a joke person. He was the story person.
Oh, handy.
Yeah. So that's why I think we worked well together. Over the years, I have become, I think I'm half and half. I'm, you know, because the truth is, jokes are disposable. The joke people are, they're the heroes. So they get to say the joke, it gets a laugh, and everyone, you know, does a victory lap. But if I were to draw up sides, you know, a team to be my next show, and I have 10 picks, the first 9 of them are going to be story people. The joke person is like the least important person is the joke writer. You need stories. It's all story. And so over the years, that's why I've moved towards, definitely towards the middle. Story is everything. I'll toss out a joke, and if they like it, great. If they don't, okay, I'll come up with another one. Don't worry. I'm not precious. I'm not, you know, stuck with it. I'm not married to it.
Are most or all sitcom rooms broken up into teams?
No, see, not really. Today, with the writing rooms have gotten so much smaller because of budgets. Yeah. You got to be able to do everything. You there's no place to hide. You can't say I'm this or that. You got to be able to do everything, or else you're not going to get hired.
Do people tend to write initially a fairly dry version that gets the story beats down and then go back and inject the jokes? Or since one person has to be good at all of it, does it just organically tend to all come in at the same time?
Yeah, it should all come in. When a writer gets sent off on draft and they get 2 weeks to write a first draft, when it comes back, it better be really good. And then at that point, like, the story has to hold together, and it'll get punched up by the writing room. But it's the room might, okay, let's take it apart and put it back together and make every line funnier. But if your script is not in the ballpark, you got a problem. You're not going to work for much longer.
Right. Speaking of how long you work, how long were you at King of the Hill?
First, so we did 4 years on Just Shoot Me. Then we left and we did 5 years on King of the Hill. Then King of the Hill got canceled. Then we jumped to another show. They wound up bringing King of the Hill back like a year or two later. At that point, we were already on another show. But we went back, I think, to maybe to write a freelance. I know I went back to do a character voice on one of the episodes. But after we left, I think it went on for another maybe 4 or so years.
You went back to do a character voice, you said?
Yeah, I did a little. They asked. I'm not an actor, but often when, you know, we have table reads, which the actors sit around, they read the script, and we do a rewrite based on what's working, what's not working. And so usually the actors were there, but if the actors couldn't make it, one of the writers would sub.
Sure.
And so I would often sub for Kathy and Jimmy, who played Peggy.
Ah.
So there was an episode idea where someone had, they thought it'd be funny if I was one of the writers, thought it'd be funny if I played one of the parts. So she brought me back.
This is maybe a bizarre question, or maybe not. When you were working on King of the Hill, you'd been on a live action show. Is the fact that it was an animated show something to be considered in any particular way by the writer's room, or were you just writing a sitcom that happened to be animated?
For sure. I mean, in many ways, Just Shoot Me was more of a cartoon than King of the Hill is. King of the Hill is very realistic. It's not, you know, it just happens to be animated.
Over the years, I've said to several people, that is a strange show because I would miss Mike Judge's acting. But beyond that,
yeah,
that absolutely could have been a live action show.
Yeah.
Just take those scripts and away we go.
Yeah, it was kind of like each week was a miniature movie. And many of the King of the Hill writers went on to write movies afterwards because it was kind of a good training ground then.
Have you ever had any involvement in the writing on any features or any interest in doing that sort of thing? And I realize at this point in the age of streaming, the definition of a feature is probably getting a little fuzzy.
Well, yes, my partner and I, when we were on King of the Hill, we decided to try our hand in the features on the side, you know, as a side hustle. So we wound up selling two feature scripts to 20th Century Fox. It was fine. I'd much prefer working in television to features. You know, we did it, but that was it.
And why do you prefer television? Is it more about the writer's room and the team, or is it just about the fact that you're more familiar with and enthusiastic about television, or
no,
is it something else?
It's really in TV, the writer's in charge. In film, the director's in charge. In film, the writer is really secondary. Like it's just like you're disposable. You'll write, you can spend years on a project and it'll never get made. Most movies never get made. You can make a good living, or, you know, back then you could make a good living and never have your work seen. But in TV, you know, you're working every week and you're coming up with stories and you get to see your, you know, a couple of weeks later, there it is, you're watching it on TV. And then you're doing it again and again. And it's just, it's more interesting. If you're a control freak and you're a writer, you absolutely want to work in television. You not in film.
How are things going these days with the smaller writing rooms, with the mini rooms? Are they still able to get the job done well? I mean, I realize there's little flexibility in how it runs. It runs how it runs, but how's that working out?
Well, that was part of the issue of the writer's strike, which was last year.
Yeah.
Right now, there's not a ton of work in television as the industry is contracting. So we'll see what the fallout is. But you gotta roll with the punches. And that was part of the reason why I wanted to get into writing books and touring and performing it. I just wanted to be less, I want to have more control over my work and be less at the mercy of what Hollywood wants from me today.
And if you could sit down and tackle just any sort of project that you cared to tackle, whether it was TV or film, regardless of genre, do you have something in mind that you'd like to do that's the sort of thing you've never been involved with before?
Well, I'm a comedy writer, so I stick to that. To me, the most exciting work I've done is my book, A Paper Orchestra. I would like to write more of that. I like to make, right now, I guess I'm a TV writer who writes books on the side. I'd like to flip it. I'd like to be a book writer who writes TV on the side. I'd like to, we'll see what happens with my book, and maybe I can sell it as a television show at some point in a few years. But to me, that's what excites me right now, is that at this stage in my career and the kind of writing that I'm really enjoying. I just, you know, I'm at the point where you know, a lot of people don't realize this, but as a television writer, I don't write what I want to write. I write what someone pays me to write.
Sure.
And I'm fine with that. It's a good arrangement, you know, but in terms of writing what I want to write, well, then that means I got to do it on myself.
So if you get around to writing more books, do you imagine it's going to be more essays about real life experiences you've had, or you're interested in doing something different from that?
No, I love this form. I love the form essay writing. I just think it's so, to me, I think the stakes are so much higher. When we talk about writing and you talk, what are the stakes of the character? What's going to happen to this character? In a novel, if the character, you may love this character, and if at the end of the book, the character falls off a cliff and dies, as a reader, you might be, whoa, that's rough. I love that character. I'm sad. You know, I was certainly that way at the end of A Prayer for Owen Meany. Mm-hmm. But when you read a personal essay, the stakes are so much higher because this is a real person you're talking about. And so I just think it's so much more interesting. I think this is where, well, I don't want to predict what the future is going to be, but to me, I don't know. I'm happy to discover auto fiction because I just think it's, I don't know. I think we'll be seeing more writing like that in the future from other writers as AI begins to encroach on our careers.
Oh, egads, we don't have the hours to talk about that. Yeah. But as it begins to encroach, as it has begun to encroach. Yuck.
So as Brian mentioned at the top, I've been following you on social media since your sort of inception of it. And you've managed to build your following up to almost, I think, between both the platforms, is that 600,000 now?
Yeah. Maybe more. It's, you know, there's Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And yeah.
Right.
Something like that.
I have some friends who are novelists, and was it a strategy to sort of build up your social media for your book and to also your way of giving back? And is that sort of necessary for an unknown writer?
Yeah. I don't know. You know, when I wrote the book and I gave it to my agent, he said, in this genre, personal essays, platform drives acquisition. I said, well, what does that mean? He said, you need to have a social media following. Now, if I were to write in a different genre, that would probably be, I probably wouldn't need one as much. But for certainly auto fiction or personal essays or memoir, there's not a ton of demand for that from people like me. So you needed a following. And so I was like, okay, good. Give me a year. I'll tell you what I can come back with. And so that's, you know, why I started doing it. And it eventually, it really gave me a lot more career control over my career. Like now I can, when I tour, I can perform, I can tour, I can go on social media and say, hey, I got a show coming up. Go here to buy tickets. And so it gives me a lot of agency in terms of, you know, not being beholden on anyone in Hollywood to help me with my career. I can do it myself.
Now that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
I can publish it, market it, and I can keep most of the money.
Right. Just best part.
How much do you enjoy show running? And are all showrunners writers too, or at least once were? I assume that's how you get to being a showrunner is coming in through that door.
Yes, right. The showrunner is basically executive producer and the head writer. So when you're a showrunner, you are a writer.
You don't always. Okay.
You're always a writer and you're the head writer. So it's a lot of writing. It's a lot of, you're rewriting other writers' work. My partner and I have run three shows, but we've also, the last show we were on, we were not the showrunner, and you don't make as much money. You don't have as much control. And it was delightful. I'm okay with that. I was working, the showrunners were great guys and I'm there to help them make their vision. And it was a wonderful experience. And I'm happy to do that as well. So it's not, it's not an ego thing where I need to be the boss. It's a very stressful job, being showrunner. Very stressful.
Oh, yeah. A lot of bucks stop with you. Well, all of them. And there's a lot of them, I'm sure. Along the way in your career, have you ever struggled with imposter syndrome? If so, how'd you get over it? Or have you not gotten over it? Or what does that look like for you?
You know, the first day I started posting on social media, I was like, I didn't know anything about TikTok. And I was like, isn't that the app where the 13-year-old girls shuffle dance? Like, am I going to be the creepy old man on here? And then also, I felt like, well, and who am I to say anything? Like, I'm not nearly as successful as Aaron Sorkin or Shonda Rhimes. Like, who am I? I no one's heard of me. I'm a working writer. I'm a journeyman. I'm just a guy who's made a career out of writing television. No one's ever heard of me. No one's ever heard of most TV writers, but certainly I'm not Chuck Lorre. I'm not, you know, so I was like, well, who am I to be talking, giving any advice? And my wife was like, but you're you. I mean, you're not pretending to be Chuck Lorre. You're not pretending to be, have that level of success. You're being honest about where your success is, which is not nothing. And so I was like, okay. But even still, even before I started writing the book, you know, I'd never written a book before. And I immediately had imposter syndrome about writing the book. I was like, because I'm promoting the book. I'm telling everyone, hey, it's coming out in a year or whatever. And I'm saying, hey, come to my shows. I perform my work. I had never performed my work. I had never read it out. Like, I didn't know if it was good. I just thought it was good. And so, yeah, it was all like, you never get over it. You just never get over thinking, am I doing it right? You know, I don't know. Am I doing it right? And then when so getting back to David Sedaris, I read his work and I'm like, well, he's doing it right. He's very successful. People love his writing. And then I'm doing at first I was like, well, I should just write the way he writes because he's successful. That, you know, that he, there's a demand for what he does. Why don't just do what he does? But then as I was writing it, I was like, but this is terrible. Like, I just felt like I was a fraud. I was imitating him. And then I happened to catch, I draw a lot of inspiration actually from musicians, like, and artists about like what art is. I had long talks with my wife about what art is, because I was trying to make art as opposed to just sitcoms. And I saw an interview by Pharrell, you know, the musician, and he said it so clearly. I was like, oh, good. He basically said, you know, because I was, the way I write is very different from the way David Sedaris writes. And I was like, well, is that okay? Is it allowed? You know, is that okay? Because he's the gold standard. Is it okay if I'm doing it differently? And then basically Pharrell's advice was, it's your job to do it differently. Like, it's not your job to do whatever someone else is doing. Your job as an artist is to take something uniquely you and put that out in the world, and you're not a knockoff artist. You want to make something original. So that really gave me the freedom to think, okay, so it's okay that what I'm doing is different from him. It's okay.
It's not just telling the story only you can tell, but it's also telling it in the way that only you could manage.
Yes, exactly. And the only way I can do it. And the way I can do it is basically drawing on my experience as a screenwriter. So that's why my work tends to feel, I think, very visual, and feels like, oh, this could be a movie, that kind of thing.
So you said that you imagined or hoped down the road it could possibly become a series or a film or something.
Yeah, and if it doesn't, I'm totally okay with it. It's not even my aspiration. I just thought, you know, I know my agents want me to say that. I'll say it, but if it doesn't, I'm okay. As long as it's a book and I can perform with it, I'm really very happy with it.
Right. You didn't write it for the purpose of turning it into something else. You wrote it
right
for the art that it is.
Right. If I wanted to sell a TV show, I'd do that. That's what I already do that. I wanted to do something that was me, and uniquely me. And like I said, I don't know what, it's hard to know if it's art or not, but that's what I was shooting for.
Have you considered, unless I'm misunderstanding that you have been involved in this in the past, but have you considered developing a TV show series, limited series from the ground up that is your project from the start?
We've sold, I don't even know how many pilots, dozens of pilots. Most of them do not even get shot. And forget about even getting air.
Sure.
But even then, even when you sell a pilot that we develop and we put our hearts into, you know, the studio's paying you, they're paying a lot of money, they have notes, they're going to turn into what they want. And that's fair because they're paying you for it. But it's never, you know, you get notes all the time. And sometimes the notes make it better. Sometimes the notes make it worse. But 100% of the time, the notes make it less mine and more ours.
We've got a lot of people in our audience who are very interested in getting staffed in writer's room for television. What do you imagine people might find the most surprising or the least intuitive about what life is like in a writer's room if they are fortunate enough to get staffed?
Well, your job as a writer, when you get staffed, most people think my job is to make the best TV show possible. And I'm gonna do that. And that's not your job. Your job is to make the best version of the show that the showrunner wants to make. It's their show. They sold it. And so you're there to help them in whatever way they want. And you're there you're not there to argue with them. You're there to help, you know, it's their show. When you get your show, you're not going to want people to argue with you and tell you, you don't know what you're talking about. And I see people get fired all the time. Young writers, this happens all the time. I see young writers get on a show, they get their break, and then they don't get asked back season two. A lot of them simply don't understand what story is yet. They have talent, but they haven't figured out how to, you know, it takes so long to learn how to write. It really does. So I see a lot of people flame out, which is sad.
So it's not that uncommon that you see people who apparently had enough chops to make it into the room, but they didn't really understand the assignment when they got there.
Yeah. Or they didn't have the ability to, I didn't have the ability either when I first started on Just Shoot Me. But I was able, the writing staffs were bigger then. So I was able to hide for the first couple of years of my career. Now you have no place to hide because the rooms are so much smaller. You can't hide.
You got to take advantage of the signal to noise ratio to sort of hide. Interesting. So you feel like you weren't really prepared. And what was the problem? What was the challenge for you? What didn't you understand or appreciate once you got in there?
It's 100% story structure. I remember pitching on ideas, and I'd pitch an idea and be met with silence. And another writer would pitch an idea, and then everyone would say, "That's great." And I remember even me, I'd be like, "That's great. How do I know the difference between a good idea and a bad idea?" I certainly knew their ideas were better than mine, but I didn't know how to do it myself. And so that takes a long time to develop that skill. At the beginning of the pandemic, when I was unemployed, I came up with a screenwriting course that kind of teaches a lot of this stuff, because it's so important for people to understand. It's just, most people think that writing is like by the gut, and it's just not. It's like, there's just so much that you have to know in order to give the audience or the reader what they're looking for, or else it's just self-indulgent. And that's what your diary's for. And I encourage people to have a diary, but if you want people to read, to like what you write, then you have to write what they want, not what you want.
Now, I know that we're going to have a bunch of listeners who are very early in their journeys, who are going to hear what you just said and say, there's a formula for making it work. Yeah. What do you say to them?
No, there's no formula. If there was a formula, the writers would have been fired a long time ago, and the computers would be doing it. So, because the studios love to get rid of writers. There's elements that a story has, that every good story has, and it doesn't matter whether it's like an indie film or a big blockbuster or a foreign film. Like, these are all things that a story, these moments that every good story has to have to feel like a story, and that is non-negotiable. Once you have those moments, like the execution of that structure can be good or bad. And that's what makes a movie or a TV show or a novel good or bad, is how it's executed. So there's still plenty of, like, I could give you this structure and you could still screw it up. You know what I'm saying? There's still plenty of time for you to screw it up, and myself included, you know? So structure is not formulaic. It's knowing what a story is.
So the writer who's working from their gut to make decisions about the motivations of a character, fine. But if you're working from your gut to decide what makes a scene or makes a sequence, then no, you're probably in trouble.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, if your work is not being received the way you want it to be received, and that means even when your mom reads it, even if she's, "Oh, it's good," you know, if she gives you one of those, if your work is not being received as well as you want it to be, it's because that's on you. It's not their fault. It's your fault.
Yeah.
And that requires studying the craft. And, you know, when you want to become an NBA basketball player, you've been playing all your life, every day since after school as a kid. Then you went to college and you played every day. And then maybe you make a team if you're one of the better ones. Maybe you'll make it. But either way, you've been playing every day for since you're a child. Most people start writing, like, you know, last year. "Hey, how come I can't sell it? I spent a whole year on this script." Okay, but you haven't been working as a writer. You haven't been working. You haven't been writing every day for your child. Like, if you want to compete at the highest levels, which is the professional level, you got to, you know, sorry, you got to put your hours in.
For people working on getting themselves an education about some of the basics, what's the difference between story and plot? Do I really need to be thinking about subtext? All of those things.
Yeah.
What's a great way for them to get started?
Well, first of all, the fact that you know the difference between story and plot, when most people do not, is a really good start. And most people do not. Most people just write a plot.
Yes.
I do webinars. I also have a screenwriting course, and I'm working on a course right now. After I put the book out, people are like, "Well, can you write a course on writing memoir?" And I'm like, I did it once. Like, I'm not really sure I'm the best person, but enough people said, "No, we like the way you write it." So I'm putting together a course called Mining Your Life for Stories, which is basically either personal essay or memoir, or people who just, they want to take an element of their own life and turn it into a movie or a short story or whatever. Which I think is a great idea to do that, to mine your life for stories. So that I'm working on a course like that, and that'll be done. I don't know, maybe by the time this podcast goes up, I'm probably about a month or so away from having that ready. But yeah, my advice I give to everybody, like I said, I have like these courses and you can go to my website, study from someone, study from me or study from somebody else. I would say it really helps though to vet whoever you're studying from and read their work. And if you don't like their work, myself included, then don't study from them. They're not going to be able to write better than, they're not going to be able to teach you better than they are, you know? And so, but most people don't. They just think, oh, this person has a website or they're standing behind a lectern. Therefore, they are a teacher. They can teach me. No, you got to do your due diligence. You got to, the quality of teacher and writer varies greatly. So read their work. And if you like it, they might be for you. And if you don't like it, find somebody else.
When you were perfecting your writing, did you do a lot of reading of existing screenplays, teleplays or scripts or whatever terminology we use these days? Did you do a lot of reading as a part of that, either in school or elsewhere?
Yes. Back then, what that looked like was reading scripts of existing television shows. So I'd go to the Writers Guild of America and they had a library. You'd check out some scripts, or now it's much easier. You can get them online. A lot of it was also just watching TV shows, but making notes about the storyline, literally on a pad and writing what the scene is and how the scene, and that would help. And then my partner and I would get together and talk about it. And then a lot of it was referring to other, as we were writing our own scripts, we'd be like, oh, but how did they handle this moment on that show? And there's a lot of, even now when we're working on a script, yesterday my partner and I were working, and we're working on a script because, well, how did we do it on that last script? Like, you know, like we're referring to work that we had written before to see how we had handled certain moments. Cause, every time you write, you're starting from scratch. It's like, how do I do this again? It's very hard.
As I believe you alluded to earlier, if all of writing is hard, if it doesn't seem hard, you're not doing it right. Or you don't fully appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah.
If you were talking to somebody at a party and they said, oh, you're a writer. That's you're a writer. That's interesting. What's it like being a writer? How would you answer that?
A TV writer or a writer?
Okay, let's get specific. Oh, okay. Let's go TV writer. Oh, you're a TV writer. Huh? What's that like?
Wouldn't do it. Because first of all, someone's going to say, I've fallen to this trap. Oh, you should write a story. You should write a show about my workplace. Well, we're crazy. Oh, really? What happened? Oh, well, Frida came in. She brought cake, but then Larry hid all the cake. Okay. Yeah. I mean, but it's so crazy. We're wacky. I'm not interested in that conversation. I've had it too many times. So I don't, when I go to parties, if I ever go to a party, I don't even, I change the subject. Let's talk about you. I'm more interested in you than talking about me. So.
Well, and that's a really wise thing to do, because only with a conversation like that are you potentially going to get an interesting new experience or new conversation that could find its way into your next memoir. Or do we not use the word memoir? I did notice that the word memoir is not on the cover of your book.
That might have been a mistake. I don't know.
You think?
You know, I have a reaction to that word memoir.
It is a little
self-important, right?
It's a little white hanky. Yeah.
Yeah. That's how I felt. Although, like, I'm writing my memoir, that kind of thing.
Right. But, oh, I didn't even know you were important. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
And so I didn't, from what I understand, it's actually a pretty big category where people like to read memoir. So probably, I probably should have used those keywords more. But, and I didn't, personal essay, I don't like either, because no one wants to read an essay. That sounds like homework. There's no good word for it. And so I call it on my book, True Stories. I'm not sure if that's better than any of them either. I'm not sure. I wish there was a better word to describe how I write, because they are true stories, but it's not like, it's not, my life is not so interesting. These stories are true, but I fictionalize them. I dramatize them. So it doesn't feel like I'm telling you a play-by-play account of some boring event. I'm trying to get to a dig to a deeper place and like, the human condition, I guess. So I wish there was a better word.
I find our whole conversation really interesting because Bailey originally contacted you about coming on the podcast because of your experience in the TV industry and your screenwriting experience. And that was our initial interest. And then we found out about your non-memoir.
Yeah.
And damn, if that's not one of the most interesting things about you. I encourage people in our audience to check the book out. It's fantastic. We've got people spread around the country and around the world that are involved in the Story Summit organization that we're involved in that sponsors the podcast and all that. And so obviously a very small percentage of people are going to be able to attend one of your live readings. And so at least read the book. If you get to see him performing live, absolutely do that.
Oh, thank you.
Michael, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. It's been a pleasure chatting
with you. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you for having me. I love talking to other writers, so this was a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure for us as well.
Absolutely.
Hope we'll get a chance to talk again one of these days.
Great. Okay, guys. Bye-bye now.
Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Michael.
Ah, well, that was a great chat with Michael Jamin. He obviously knows of what he speaks, and he's so generous in sharing it and so good at sharing it. I understand why he's had success both in doing and teaching. He's very open and plain spoken, and he understands that when you make your living as a writer, some things you do are capital A art. And I hope our audience can hear my air quotes. And some things just aren't. But that doesn't mean there isn't artistry in getting the work done well and on a schedule, too. To me, it felt like a realistic peek behind the curtain of the industry. And I meant what I said about his book along the way. There is absolutely some capital A art going on there. And hearing him talk about the process of getting that book done is a nice reminder that you can have a successful writing career and then still find yourself up against a lot of the same challenges that an emerging writer struggles with. Like, who am I and what am I trying to say here? And I think I need to throw this away and start over. And I love that he was inspired by David Sedaris to take his artistry into his own hands and write this. David Sedaris is very inspiring, but I think it's tricky using David Sedaris as inspiration because he does manage to make it look so obvious and easy. But, well, that sort of writing, it is not obvious and easy in the least.
If someone were to want to check out a David Sedaris book who hasn't is unfamiliar with his work, do you have any suggestions that, like, maybe someone like myself, I could start?
I think a good place to start with David Sedaris is Me Talk Pretty One Day, which is a great title. And it's not the only great title he's got. He has a very specific voice, which comes through in his titles as well. Like Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls and
interesting
Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk. When You Are Engulfed in Flames. So you've just got to read something with those titles, right?
Definitely.
You know it's going to be out there and that you're going to be reading something a little atypical.
Yes.
But back to Michael Jamin. I believe it was Michael Jamin and not David Sedaris we interviewed. So,
yes.
I will also say this about Michael Jamin. His social media presence, as we were discussing in the intro, is so impressive and generous regarding industry knowledge. And he shows up a variety of places. So I suggest you go to his homepage at michaeljamin.com. It's Michael, J-A-M-I-N. .com, and you'll find links there to what he's up to online. So a big final thanks to our wonderful guest this episode, television writer, showrunner, and much as he may dislike the title, memoirist Michael Jamin. And thanks as well to Story Summit for making this podcast possible. To meet other writers, turbocharge your craft, and learn about the career opportunities writers care about, it really doesn't get any better than the generous people at Story Summit. Please check them out now at storysummit.us. Thanks for listening, everyone, and until next time, keep writing. And if a career as a writer is your goal, well, you're gonna hear a lot of no's, but don't give up because all it takes is that one single yes. I've been your host, Brian Landwehr. This episode produced by myself and Bailey Patterson with the support of David Paul Kirkpatrick of Story Summit.
I hope to be a writer myself someday.
Original music by Kenton Edwards.